This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 133, brought to you in association with Smart Pension. And today, we're joined by Ellis Cedar, CEO of Santa Monica Talent, to talk about a topic we haven't specifically covered before, but which I'm sure is of interest to many of you, the tech labour market. If you're in it, are you underpaid or overpaid? If you're not in it and wish to get in it, how do you do that? Will you find happiness ever after? Santa Monica Talent helps startups scale up and build out teams in many sectors, of which FinTech is one. One of the feathers in their hat is helping super well-known digital marketing and social media superstar Gary Vaynerchuk build out VaynerMedia in London. Ellis himself has spent many years in Asia in the recruitment world, so speaks from a depth of experience. Many of his suggestions apply to all our careers. As he told me the other day, LinkedIn isn't supposed to be a CV. Oops. No wonder I live in a cardboard box, only coming out occasionally to podcast. So if you want to live in a palace and not live in a cardboard box, listen up. Plenty to talk about. So let's get on with the show. Hi, Ellis. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Mike. How's it going?
So in terms of picking a topic, you said you weren't interested in football. and then you demonstrated your lack of interest in football by indicating that you're a season ticket holder at Arsenal, which is clearly a good proof of having no interest in football. He says there's an ex-Aston Villa fan. But maybe you take a different view.
Yes, it has been suffering now for, I think, 12 years. Not much fun for the Arsenal fans. I mean, when we look over the road at Spurs and Chelsea. But let's move on to more fun topics.
So let's not, actually, because I like making people squirm and... It's the only part of the podcast where I can actually sort of get my own in, because then we go into stuff where you know and I don't. So is it all the fault of that sort of French chap or the board? Or if I put you in charge of Arsenal tomorrow, how would you turn it around on a five-year plan?
Well, we won't mention the French gentleman's name. Unfortunately, he overstayed his welcome. But football's very cyclical, and right now Spurs are going through their glory years, even though there's no trophies in their cabinet. And it might take 3 to 5 years to rebuild this Arsenal team. But I don't think the owners have the same agenda as the fans, really. If you look at how they run the club, it's all about maximising profit. And if that means finishing sixth and spending 40 million and having profits of 100 million, then that's fine for them. They don't need to spend 300 million to finish third. So I think the Arsenal fans have to accept that for the moment.
Yes, that's interesting, actually, because as I mentioned before on the podcast, when I supported football, all the Villa back in the 70s, wages were so low that even centre forwards who scored lots of goals, when they retired, would have to go off and run a pub because they had no money.
Yeah, it's true.
And so I knew how football worked then, and I've largely missed the intervening decades. How does it work then in other football clubs? Because there are financial pressures, the wages are just ludicrous, the transfer costs are just ludicrous. So some FD has to sit there with his little spreadsheet going, oh, we're bankrupt, or actually we made a profit. So how do the better firms who actually succeed, how do they reconcile the need not to go bust and to make a profit with the, as you put it, the need to actually make the fans happy and win a few trophies?
Well, the winning trophies has been put down the list of priority for the football clubs. Now, the fans don't like this.
But somebody wins the trophy every year, though. When I was young, someone won the league every year and someone won the FA Cup and League Cup, and that still happens.
Absolutely. And apart from the 1 year of the unbelievable Leicester title, it typically is the team that spends most money on wages. I mean, it's a direct correlation, has been for 25 years. So you can go all the way back to the beginning of the Premiership, 93, and the team that spends most money on the wages typically will win the title. And if they don't win the title, it'll be in the top two. There's not really any shortcuts around this. But I do think the latest model, most of the Premier League clubs, just by being in the Premier League, the money that they gain from TV rights, not even including being in Europe, is enough to make it super profitable because the asset goes up every year. So even if you hold on to a mid-tier club like Southampton for 10 years, if you bought Southampton for, I don't know what the numbers are, but let's say you bought Southampton for £100 million, in 10 years' time, that could be worth £500 million just for inflation and because of TV rights. So they just need to keep the club in the Premiership. And I think that's pretty much what Arsenal is doing right now. They're just keeping the club just above water because the worst case scenario for them is they finish seventh. The best case scenario is they finish third. So there is no point of the club spending £300 million this summer because they still can't finish in the top two. They're just simply nowhere near as good as Manchester City and Liverpool. Now, the fans don't want to hear this, but this is the brutal truth. I don't like it.
So it's an interesting example because it applies to many things I'm thinking about. And obviously, it does relate to what the topic of the podcast is in terms of the market for talent. There's a market for talent in everything. It's an interesting example of how we've gone pretty much from the English vibe of sport being an amateur thing, in the cases of cricket and that, the amateur thing for gentlemen as well as the players, to a more Americanized business model where somebody owns a baseball club and there's real talent and there's real money involved. And while you were talking about football, I was thinking about things that I follow, which MotoGP. And MotoGP is dominated in recent years by Honda, Yamaha and Ducati sort of also ran a little bit, and that correlates very highly with the amount of money that Honda put into their team as opposed to the smaller teams. And even in a very minority sport like winter biathlon, the large teams like Norway have waxing trucks which follow the biathletes around, and they wax the skis and they have like 100 pairs of skis each. Whereas if you're sort of somebody from Estonia, you know, you've got your bottle of wax in the evening and you're waxing your ski yourself. And again, unsurprisingly, that and all the sports physios and sports psychologists and training and all that kind of stuff, it dominates it.
But the difference between American sports and the Premier League, there's a couple of major differences. American sports, salary cap.
Okay.
So they brought salary caps in 20, 25, 30 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And that was specifically to stop billionaire owners buying one team and dominating the league, because that wouldn't be good for anybody. So they saw this. So every one of the major sports leagues have a cap depending on where you finish, how much revenue you make, and it equals out all the divisions. So until the Premier League brings in a salary cap, we're going to constantly have the problems of an unbalanced league, all dependent on who the richest owners are. I mean, it is possible, but the challenge you have with this is that you would need all of Europe to agree. Because if the Premier League has let's say they have a 50 million salary cap per team, well, if Spain and Italy don't agree to this, then simply the players will go to Spain and Italy. So the top six or eight leagues in Europe have to agree to a unified salary cap, which is consistent with each other. And only then, I think, will you get a much fairer, evened out. I mean, Italy, you've got Juventus just won the title something like seven times in a row. I mean, it's not good for anybody.
Yes, so very interesting point. So the salary cap is the mechanism, but underlying that mechanism, which enables the Americans to do it, is they invented their own sports that nobody else plays. So the World Series of Baseball is sort of remarkably small in terms of the number of international companies participating.
That helps. The other thing as well, the American owners, is that they never really take into account there's no relegation in American sports.
There's one league for baseball and one league for...
Yeah, I mean, they have minor leagues and so forth. They do have secondary leagues, but if you're a major team and you're the New York Yankees, you can't get relegated, which is the difference sometimes when I think they take over teams in Europe. I don't think they take this into account, because if they don't invest enough and they slip off and then they go into the next division, it's a disaster.
Okay, so moving on from talent in sport, which is an interesting conversation, in terms of talent in tech. As I mentioned before, you are not just a fintech thing. You scale up startups. Nice phrase that trips off the tongue as long as one is fairly sober. Which tech sectors are you involved in then, Ellis?
So mostly we work across fintech, insurtech, health tech, digital agencies, prop tech. Anything AI is exciting for us. Digital incubators. And we tend to gravitate towards startups with a social responsibility, social impact. We just tend to enjoy working with them more.
Okay, and so, I mean, the commonality between them is that they're all kind of tech, and but then everything is in the modern world. How much does the sort of culture differ between the different ones? I mean, I assume, knowing nothing, that for the sake of argument, biotech is a bit sort of sciencey, because you need to know a little bit about molecules or something like that. So that might be a different vibe from, shall we say, fintech, or, well, insurance tech is a good example, in insurtech, which is obviously insurance-y people.
What you will typically find is the insurtech startups are more corporate than, say, the fintech startups, and then way, way more corporate than a health tech startup. What you tend to find with the health tech companies is people will take a lower salary because they are involved with doing something good 5 days a week. You know, not all the time, but the health tech companies we've worked with, they can be quite nice environments to work in. You know, if your number one aim in the company is to provide some new software that's going to help cancer treatment, I think you just have a nicer environment in general. People are kind of working towards one good common goal.
Yes, I mean, that can be the problem with finance, which is it's terribly abstract. I mean, it's a game of numbers, literally.
It is, but still, if you look inside the environment of a fintech today, compared to, say, working in one of the big retail banks or investment banks, there's still a massive world of difference between those two environments. Where I'd still say the fintech startups are quite nice places to work as well. I mean, there are a couple of exceptions, but in general, they are still more entrepreneurial, creative spaces to be.
Yes, absolutely. And I was just simply reflecting on the point about the cancer. It's an emotive example, but if your reason of getting up in the morning is that you're working on something which might actually mean that 10% more people live, that actually sort of gets you out of bed when, quite a lot. When you can't be asked, as opposed to something where all you're doing is shuffling numbers around, you're doing a currency app and it exchanges currencies, and so you do it slightly better, and then Mike goes on holiday and Mike has 0.1% more pesetas or whatever. That doesn't quite get you out of bed the same amount. Yeah. So listeners to the show will know a little bit about fintech, so we don't need to dwell too much on the fintech bit of it. But in terms of the market structure, I think this is something that where people's experience will vary enormously. I remember going to a talk by Richard Gombrich, I think I may have mentioned this on the show before, who was the someone or other professor of Sanskrit at Oxford University for his entire life. And he was reflecting back on his whole career studying Buddhism as well as Sanskrit. And he was saying that quite often his students ask him for advice. And he said one of the pieces of advice they always ask me for when they're finishing their degree is, how do I get a job? And he said, why they ask me, I don't know, because I'm the last person to ask, because I only ever had one job in my life, which was this one. And I wrote a letter to the college saying why they shouldn't appoint me. I was just completely the wrong person. And I got it. So that was that's quite a while ago. That'd be about 15 years ago. So that someone has been working for. So, that's probably 50s he was getting that job. So in the old school, you could write a letter to someone saying, actually, why I, Mike Ballam, am completely unqualified for this. And you get given it because the other person knows better. The world has changed a little bit from the 1950s where you write letters saying, why you're not qualified. Everyone these days has got this sort of come back to LinkedIn stuff and all that, is supposed to promote themselves in this much more sort of American way. But in terms of the structure of the market, there is still the direct approach, like Richard Gombrich, you write to so-and-so. Oh, actually, I think he was approached, but he wrote to them saying, why not? So you write to Barclays Bank and say, I love Barclays Bank, can I get a job? And they've got a department for that kind of stuff. Or there's websites, you apply to websites, or there's brokers and headhunters. So how does the market work as a whole?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And actually, I still think that writing directly to a company is a good form of actually being hired. But it only works in the smaller companies. It's very difficult to write to somebody. We can use Barclays as an example, just because they have, such a strong hiring process, multi-touch, various people involved, that it would be very difficult to get through that process by just sending an email or letter. But I do think it's a good advice if you want to work for a fintech startup, which is maybe under 100 people, if you sent a personalised message or letter even to the founder, I'm sure you'd get a response, as long as it was something that was sensible and, hey, look, this is my background, this is what I have been doing, I understand you could be looking for some of my skill set. I do think that's a good way to actually look for a job. It is a bit more old-fashioned, but it's going to get through the noise.
It's a good point, it still exists, and I was trying to remember, and it's completely gone out of my mind, I watch too much like you on YouTube and that kind of stuff. And there's a chap called Mark Stein, who's a Canadian host, who I started watching in particular, because I remember him, because he was the year above me at school. And he looks the same as he did then. He was interviewing somebody in a two-part, and I've completely forgotten the name. Now, this guy is obviously very important, because he got caught up in the whole Mueller investigation of Trump, and he was one of the ones that went to the slammer or something, and da-da-da-da-da-da. And he's got a very interesting career, because he got involved in spooks in London and all sorts of weird things like that. Anyway, to cut a long story short, right at the early stage of the Trump campaign, he wrote to the Trump campaign and said, look, I've been involved in politics, and I actually quite like what your candidate's doing, and I'd like to work with you, da-da-da-da-da-da. They thanked him for his letter and wrote back and said, well, actually, at the moment, there's only two of us on the campaign, because it's a super early stage,
Yeah.
So he'd written there, and they said, thank you for the thing. But then, when he was getting further and Trump was getting through it, they needed to scale it. And they remembered this guy who was interested in them when no one gave a shit. So he ended up recruiting. Anyway, the very complicated story, I'll have to find this for the show notes, but very complicated story, ended up, I think, going to the nick as a result of being sort of stitched up over Russia. And it was really interesting because it involved spies and politics. It should be made into a movie, actually. So the long story short, the point being is that in this world of tech, it's very easy to forget old school methods, and it's very easy to forget that people are people. But you know more than I, and you say that actually sometimes writing a letter expressing why I want to work for Santa Monica Talent might be a useful thing, and people are generally polite enough to reply.
I think if you're sending it to the right person, ideally the founder of the company, and it's a well put together, it can be in a traditional letter or an email or even a social media message, and you're relaying why you're a good fit for the role. I can't see why a founder wouldn't be interested to speak to you. They don't have to pay any third party agency fees. You're showing initiative. I do recommend for people to do this. I mean, the other methods are, like we discussed previously, you know, LinkedIn's quite interesting because people use it as their CV. But actually, LinkedIn, it's not really for that. It should be for, it's a PR page for what you are, what you've done, and what you want to do next. So by having your 10 or 15 or 20 year career as a CV on LinkedIn isn't that effective. I would say focus specifically on the areas that interest you and what you see yourself doing in the next 2 to 3 to 5 years, plus obviously showcasing any highlights on there. It's way more effective than just having your traditional CV on there. I still think as well, like we said, that reaching out directly is very effective. I also think attending events on companies that you're interested in and then introducing yourself again to the founder or the leadership team of why you've taken an interest in the company and you'd like to have a chat. I can't see why any company wouldn't be interested if you're being proactive enough to do that.
Yes, and it raises an interesting dimension, which is that we're talking about recruitment, but everything you ever talk about in life is a huge abstraction. And it's rather different if you're in your last year of your degree course, or if you're 30 or 40 or 50 or 60, and what your experience is and all that kind of stuff. And I was just thinking that my elder, who's now left university and starts a data science job or something in the autumn, she got it into her mind, because all the students have got into her mind, that you have to do an internship or something like that and nobody can get jobs and yada yada. Turned out not to be true, because she did get one. Anyway, she was super stressed over it. And going back to it, it's all too easy to be seduced by a world of tech. So she did what everybody at UCL did, which is like work a million hours all night, all weekend or whatever it was on your laptop and apply for a million jobs. And unsurprisingly, that has a really low success rate, because all you're doing is basically filling in your CV and all that kind of stuff, and you're just cannon fodder to something like that. And it reminded me of a book I read about sales in the late 90s, actually, which it said that the best salesmen are to an extent lazy. If you look at the performance of salesmen, the ones who do the most sales actually tend to make the fewest calls every day. Otherwise, it's kind of a version of a spam. It's, I call you, I spent 1 minute looking at you on LinkedIn. Hi, I read out whatever was on LinkedIn and something like that. You think statistically, it's like the more shots on goal, the better. But actually, you're better off actually planning your shot on goal.
But it could be something basic as well. Like, I hear this a lot with people, that they've sent out 100 applications and they've only had a couple of interviews. Sometimes it can be more basic than this. Maybe their CV just doesn't look right for whatever reason. The format's not correct. Maybe there's some basic grammar, or it could even just be it's too long. I would also suggest to people to have a professional CV writer have a look or update their CV for them. It doesn't have to cost that much, but you could get it, you know, I think even for £100, it would help a lot. There is a challenge in London, especially within the startup world. There are a lot of people that want to work in startups, and there's only X amount of jobs. For every role that's advertised, you know, I don't know the exact figures, but let's just say 100 people apply for every single role. So the chances of, like what you're saying here, like the chances of you actually landing one of your dream jobs, if you're doing the traditional game of let's send my CV out to as many companies as possible, I wouldn't like to do the numbers on that, but your chances are low. That's why I think anything you can do to stick out from the crowd, like, you know, a cleaned up LinkedIn, a nicer CV, introducing yourself to founders, it's going to help yourself.
And prior experience, presumably, talking at the very junior end, because I was very conscious. Yeah. And she's got no experience of business.
Doesn't matter so much in the startups. I mean, at the moment, we're in the Rise startup. I mean, if you look around you, it's still populated by graduates to 2-3 years experience a lot of the time. So I don't think lack of experience is a problem.
Well, this is actually the point I made to, I don't want to get stuck on her, but this is the point that I made to her, which is that, and I think she's because she kind of did the opposite of what I say, because you do the opposite of what your dad says, because what does he know about anything?
Of course.
So she applied to sort of, you know, big companies and all that kind of stuff, at which point you are cannon fodder. You know, they want to, you know, I don't know, PricewaterhouseCoopers want 1,000 graduates worldwide, or thousands worldwide, yeah. You're cannon fodder, da, 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 da. But the small ones do actually just want someone who's smart, personable and hardworking and will learn in the end, just gone that way. So anyway, so that's the recruitment at the beginning. And just on that point, in terms of differentiation, I did a talk at Henley Business School to a number of the folks there a year or two ago. One evening, as part of one of the programmes that Dan Kiernan, who's been on the show before, organised. And it was notable that the drinks afterwards, there was free drink and free food. So students, of course, and some of these were business school students, so they weren't just like kids trying to drink every free drink going. Some of them came up and spoke to me. And one of them said, oh, I've done this, this and this, and I'd like to meet Nigel Verdon and da-da-da-da-da, you know, can you help? And I'm sure I can help. So he made the effort to come and ask me if I could help.
Yeah.
He had spoken enough to me for me to understand that I'm not sending Nigel some prat that knows nothing about nothing.
Yeah, and you remember the conversation.
So the differentiation required can be relatively small, including the courage to actually go and ask some speaker Yeah, sorry, I've been trying to reach this guy, and this is why I've been trying to reach him. So that's the start of it. So then there's the getting on the thing. Then you've got your 5 years experience market and your 10 years experience market. How do things change over time? Presumably, at some point in time in your career, I don't know how this works in tech, hence having you on the show, but certainly in old school FS, right, which is very different. When I started working in the 80s, it was still lifetime employment in the merchant banks. I mean, it was a really weird idea that you would move from one to other, and actually the chairman of the investment business had come from Morgan Grenfell, and everyone thought that was rather strange and, you know, very weird. So, but anyway, that market has gone away, where you had one job, one company for life, and you now have a dozen or so. So how do you get yourself headhunted, as it were? If you've got 10 years in this world, say, or 5 or 10, or whatever's big number.
An interesting stat is, on average, people are only staying in tech companies for 2 years, 1 month, and that includes Google and Facebook. So if Google and Facebook can only keep hold of you for 2 years, 1 month, and what they provide is unbelievable. They're like 5-star hotels inside. People are moving around a lot. And it's not necessarily for money, because I don't think people get big pay rises in London particularly. I just think in general, people are looking for new opportunities and something that's going to be exciting. But how do you get headhunted? LinkedIn. It really is as basic as that.
So the fact I've never been headhunted in my life is a reflection of my LinkedIn profile.
Well, possibly, because think about how LinkedIn works and how either the in-house recruitment departments or agencies or HR or founders directly. It's very SEO friendly. So they'll be searching on LinkedIn on keywords. So they'll be looking for a sales director with SaaS experience, with fintech experience. So that's what they'll be typing in. So if you don't have that screaming on your LinkedIn profile, you won't be coming up in the searches. So if you are looking to be headhunted, updating your LinkedIn with as much SEO friendly keywords as what you want to do next, and also ideally some thought leadership articles, not every day, but so and so, so you come into people's first connections. That's pretty much how to get headhunted. Also, speaking at events, I think that one of the good things about the tech startup scene, it's very visual. There's events on, especially in London, there's events on every day. You can go to 2 or 3 events a day if you wanted to. So being on stage and talking about your specific area of expertise, that's going to get you noticed.
Yes, it's interesting because people don't always do the kind of almost obvious or right things. So example is, it was 2 weeks ago, I had to sit through and pass through 250 emails, which have been incoming, with folks who wanted to be on the show, some applying directly, some PR companies, etc. It's just like a nightmare task. So I understand what it's like for a big company working through piles of CVs, because I don't have more than about 30 seconds each time. I should have. And one thing that's super rare, which is somebody that sort of has thought about it from my perspective, which is, Mike's probably got loads of people pinging him and he's super busy, and they send like 3 sentence or whatever. Yeah, what is the most prevalent is, I'm just spammed by some sort of PR company, you know, oh, our client, friend of the president, friend of the Dalai Lama, you know, God's right hand man, has founded every fintech, every tech going in the world, swam the Atlantic, yada yada yada, he's in London, you know, would you like to interview him? They haven't even noticed that on the bloody website it says London Fintech Podcast. You know, the sort of spammy one where they're sending it out to millions. But very few people bother to spend even 10 minutes on my website and work out what it is I'm trying to do.
Just basic research.
Basic research. It is this scattergun. It is this, let's go for the law of numbers. Let's contact a million people. And thinking about the content point, actually, very rarely do I get someone who says, actually, my client, Ellis Cedar, leading light in the world of recruitment, blah, blah, blah. He'd like to talk about so-and-so. And here's a couple of things he did recently. So I could quickly flick through and think, oh, that's an interesting line. Because, of course, what do all forms of journalists, I didn't see myself as a journalist, but what do all forms of journalists want? They want something interesting and new to talk about.
Yeah.
And, you know, so even something as simple as pinging me, saying, look, he wrote this. And I might think, oh, that's complete bollocks, I don't want that guy. But at least I know. Or, oh, that's really interesting, I hadn't thought of that before.
But I don't think people are taught this anyway. We've done a couple of shows at some of the London business schools for the recent MBA grads. One thing that's noticeable is that they're not taught how to get a job. It's quite interesting when you speak to them, because they're obviously super smart, but then no one sat down with them and said, and this is how you get your job once you have your MBA. So if no one's telling you how to get a job, then you instinctively just go back to what you think you should do, which is, I'll send my CV out to as many jobs as I possibly can, and surely something will land. It really doesn't work very well. And even the smaller companies, honestly, for every role that we'll advertise, if it's for one of our, you know, exciting startups, we'd still get to 250, 300 responses per role. And remember, only 5% are probably suitable for each position. And that's us in a very small environment. Imagine if you are, like you said, imagine you're transfer-wise. How many CVs must they get per position?
Yes, so it's a sales thing. So you don't want to just maximise the number of CVs out there. I mean, I think it's understandable, because again, going back, I think you still even said, look, in the modern world, it's really tough to get a job, so send your CV out as much as possible. So then they all focus on the volume. But actually, yeah. Having one dart, as it were, and lobbing it at a dartboard that's 100 metres away is very unlikely to sort of, you know, hit the double top. So it's a Goldilocks thing. You can send too few out, you can send too many. But I think you do need this balance of actually, for the sake of argument, I don't know, it depends on which segments of the market you are, for the sake of argument, research them at least for half an hour, an hour. Provide some content, as you say, some presence in the marketplace.
You can also A-B test it as well. I mean, like you would any digital marketing campaign, A-B test your CV, what you're saying in the email, who you're targeting. It certainly wouldn't hurt, as long as it's the message is consistent.
Okay, so those are some ideas about how to get recruited. I mean, it sounds like, Ellis, not to create work for you, but you should run a few seminars and workshops yourself. You know, just charge people 20 quid and give them a cold pizza.
I honestly think maybe I have 6 or 7 of these phone calls a week with candidates that are asking me, you know, it's the same question. It's like, talk to me, like, what do I do to improve my chances here? So it's very consistent. Like, everyone's got the same problems.
Well, the other thing is that the market is always telling us what the market wants. And we, like me, with these 250 emails coming in, we all regard it as a nuisance, all a hassle. But actually, this hassle means that some service isn't being provided somewhere in the market. We're in the Barclays Innovation Warehouse today. There's no reason you couldn't run a seminar every quarter, just charge $10 on the entrance, up to 100 people telling you what to do with your LinkedIn, how to get jobs and all that kind of
That's
stuff.
Because idea.
There's very few people out there who have perfected it at any stage. Doesn't matter what age you are.
Because you know why? There's no one answer. There's no magic wand.
Some basic principles, though. Don't have a LinkedIn profile like mine, for example.
I mean, let's put it this way. In this day and age, if someone sends me a CV without a LinkedIn profile, I'm nervous. I can't think of a reason why you wouldn't have a LinkedIn profile in this day and age. I think it would go against
you. And photos.
Photos, yes.
If I look at somebody and there isn't a photo there, I think that's a bit strange.
Photos I'm less bothered about, to be honest, Drew. I mean, actually, the very latest trend in the States is removing photos.
Why? Because it's sexist or something?
It's not so much sexist.
You could remove names.
Well, yes, it's removing names, photos and education. No, I'm serious. It's unbiased hiring.
I'm sure you are. I'm just laughing at the world. It's clown world, Hong Kong.
It's unbiased hiring.
So hang on, one second. Yeah. So I wouldn't be... I'm unbiased, and I'm not joking, because I've seen this in the civil service or heard of it in the civil service. I don't want to be biased by whether you've got any fucking experience in this at all and know some shit.
Well, no, there has to be experience for the role, but I think what they've found in the States is people were getting jobs depending on not so much for their background and skill set, but where they went to university and do they look the right fit for the company in regards to, you know, name and address. So if you eliminate that, surely you should have a more even playing field. It's a very controversial subject.
We're talking about the difference between equality of opportunity and equality of outcome if we're not careful.
Yeah.
And so, look, I've never recruited anybody in the States. I've never worked in the States. But other things being equal, I would assume that someone who went to Harvard has already been prejudged and has a certain standard of education which is better than anywhere else. Because why would you pay all the money to go to Harvard and all that kind of stuff unless it gave you an advantage? You can't equalise the world. As Thomas Sowell has pointed out, people aren't equal in a family. You have a few kids, you'll soon find out they're not all equal. Everybody's not equal. So why shouldn't I be, quotes, prejudiced in favour of Harvard, unquotes? I'd be stupid to only recruit people from Harvard.
It's been tried and tested that the more diverse your workforce, the better results you have.
I'm very sceptical of this word. Diverse means?
Well, it can mean anything, really. I mean, let's put it this way. If you walk into an office and there's 25 people, let's just use this example, young guys, they've all similar background, they've all got similar education. It's going to be very difficult for that company to scale up in the future, because when anyone from outside of that background walks into the office, they're going to be very uncomfortable. Plus, it's been tried and tested. You don't get the best outcome or results. Everyone's got the same views, everyone's got the same issues. If one person's got one problem, they've all got the same problem. They're just not ideal environments to be in.
I think we can agree that if you've got an environment where there is no diversity of thought, of course, one of the things which is pushed by the people who claim to push diversity is utter uniformity of thought and utter conformity. There is one set of things that you must believe and you can't say anything else. Then that's disadvantageous. I mean, it's a bit of a tangent, but I would be very sceptical about the data for the following reason, which is having looked a lot, far too much, at corporate governance over the last couple of years, all the evidence shows that worldwide, the best managed firms that are most successful, CSFB has got a big paper on this, for example, are family firms. Family firms absolutely do not treat everybody equally. They are built up from the family. Now, why you get from that a coherence and a commitment to the firm that goes beyond sort of money. So you mentioned, for example, Google's and the Facebook's have people rotate every couple of years. There's two models. Yeah. There's the old-fashioned tribe clan model, which can be very successful, very coherent. And frankly, I've never been in a family firm where the family didn't argue the toss amongst each other anyway, because you know what families are like.
How appealing are they to work for, Mike, though? Because I think today's workforce would be very lukewarm on that type of environment. Like, if you asked your daughters, like, would you prefer to work in a family-run office?
Well, frankly, they would know nothing, because they'd never worked.
But instinctively, they would probably think to themselves, like...
No, I'm not talking about a family office. I'm talking about... The Economist had an article. Around Europe, most... big firms in Italy, most in France, most in Sweden, are family controlled. There is one family. So, and going back to my experience of being at Clark Benson, it was a family firm. And there are a lot of advantages to that in that the family's reputation is bound up with it. So it was more ethical than other firms. Now, this is slightly an academic thing, old school. And also going back to diversity, frankly, there was very little diversity in old Kleinwort's, certainly pre-Big Bang. As I mentioned before, on the main board there were about 12 directors, 10 of whom were from Eton. Now, that didn't lead to a lack of diversity of thought, because some of those have been trying to stab each other in the back for the last 40 years, from hating each other in the playground at school. Anyway, we're getting slightly off the topic there, but it's an interesting one. And we got into this little diversion via the LinkedIn thing, and my comment that I'd assume other things being equal, going to Harvard was quite a good thing. But anyway, the good thing is it's still a little bit of a free will. So if I start a company tomorrow and recruit a bunch of folks from Harvard, I can come back to me in 3 years saying there's no way I'm going to take those bastards from Harvard ever again. Can't stand them. So let's get to very direct and simple factual matters. Money. People go to work for the pleasure and sheer enjoyment of working for people above them in the hierarchy. And also sometimes they enjoy the job themselves. But also one or two people actually go there to make a few quid, because when they go to the supermarket wants money for food. So you made some interesting remark when we were talking about what to do on the show earlier, which was that you see London as quite a low-cost place, whereas I've all seen it as quite a high-cost place.
Well, it's a high cost of living, no, undisputed. I mean, one of the most expensive places in the world to live. But salaries, and I firmly believe this, haven't really gone up that much in the last 15, 20 years. I think they went down during the post-credit crunch, and I'm specifically talking high-tech, high-growth, early-stage companies here. The salaries are very, very low. You can earn an awful lot more working in a corporate. That's undisputed. I don't think everybody is aware of that, and it is a shock when people start interviewing. You know, for me personally, I try and bring this up as early as possible.
Give me an example. I mean, what are we talking about? I don't know. You're 30, 10 years experience, whatever. I don't know.
It depends on the function. I mean, software developers are paid quite consistently well for obvious reasons. But remember, software developers in a startup is only, at best, half of the office.
My guess of developers is about 75 grand these days.
I think the average is 67, but that's just the average. I mean, that goes north all the way to, you know, whatever you want to pay, really. Your initial question was, how much do they earn? It depends. I mean, if you're a software salesperson, depends on how many years of experience you have. What I tend to find is 2 to 5 years experience, salary should be about 40 base with a potential 100 OTE.
OTE?
On target earnings, if everything goes to plan. Now, the issue is you're joining a high-growth, early-stage company with lots of really interesting, exciting ideas. We don't know if you are going to sell this product to a million people. So you are taking a huge risk here. But the trade-off is more creativity in the workforce. You're allowed to use a lot more of your skill set. It's more entrepreneurial. They can be fun environments to work in. You can come in casually. The work hours are way more flexible. So you've got to trade off, what do you want from your career? Is it to work in the corporate and earn more money?
And what's the premium then, other things being equal, between startups, scale-ups, techs?
It's difficult, corporates? Again, because if we're talking, again, marketing, the salaries in marketing is very low because there's also a massive supply of talent in London. So I think the talent pool in London is about as good as it gets in the world, and I'd put New York and San Francisco in that. I think there's something like... The digital pool in London is about 300,000 people. So you're constantly competing with other good people.
So you're coming from very precise. I'm going from fag packets. Yeah. So you're working in a tech firm, in Barclays Innovation Warehouse, or you're going to work for Barclays in Canary Wharf. Do you get paid twice as much at Barclays in Canary Wharf? Other things being equal, and obviously it's a wide range.
Maybe not twice as much.
50% more, 10% more?
I'd say, okay, if you took a job at Barclays compared to a startup that's just raised Series A, your take home's probably 50% less. But you should be negotiating equity, options on a potential event. Now, the challenge on the options piece, as we know, is there are so few events that your chances of the options materialising is quite slim. Probably the most successful cases I've seen of this are people that can pick the companies wisely, they build up a portfolio of options and then keep the options when they move on to the next company. So over a 10 or 15 year
career... Are people not allowed to keep options? Because I've heard plenty of stories where people can't keep options when they leave.
All depends on what you agree. But you certainly can agree to keep options post leaving the company. As long as you leave your company in, you know, everything's gone to plan and you've shaken hands, you're moving on to your next venture. But I think the best case scenario is over a career, you have a portfolio of stock options you've built up. And hopefully, if you've worked for 5 or 6 companies, you'd have to say 1 or 2 of them, there will be an event. That's probably your best case scenario. But you'll receive that rather than a big bonus than you would in a bank.
Yes, no, I get that. I haven't had that many conversations, unsurprisingly, with people about their packages and that. But I have had 1 or 2 conversations where fintechs in London are starting to run into a problem that I saw in, well, I wasn't in Merrill Lynch, but I heard about Merrill Lynch 30 years ago, which is, and also HSBC, so about 10 years ago, which is that people are locked in by having various options packages and they can't leave. Then after a while, they start just hanging around because they got bored of working and, you know, the idea of locking people in with options works fine until time goes by and then it's 5 and 10 and 15 years because actually it can slow down your rotation.
We're still not that part of the evolution of the startup world in London. I mean, even if we look at, say, a TransferWise, you know, they call them a unicorn. So if you're locked into TransferWise on options, you're probably at the point now where you're having discussions about what's next for me. But then have you signed a contract which allows you to keep those options if we're going to move on and everything, you know, let's shake hands, or do I have to forego them? I think most people are signing contracts saying that I get to keep them. And then that's fair for both parties, if you have done your part.
I don't have that many conversations, I'm just thinking. And 1 or 2 conversations I've had are people who joined in the early days of fintech, when firms were just forming, and I can quite understand that sort of terms and conditions then would have been, look, well, you know, obviously we're going to be really spectacularly successful in 3 years and 5 years, and obviously you can't keep the options if you leave, because we were trying to bind the team together, going back to what is it that binds together. But it's not a statistical study. Anyway, that's all very interesting. We can keep talking about this all day. So before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there. I hope you're well paid where you are and enjoying your job. And if you're not, you apply some of these things about tidying up your CV and LinkedIn. I must ask Ellis whether actually the people who tidy up your LinkedIn for you get a few of them on my case, but maybe I'm a sort of a hopeless case by now. I'd also like to thank my brand partner for the podcast, Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. So talking about gaps in the market, other people who tidy up your LinkedIn CV. I think I quite like mine retro, actually. I don't think I'd change it. It's kind of 2 fingers to the modern world. I don't believe in the 21st century. I don't think it's going to last. I think it'll run out at some point.
Yeah, you're more of a zombie apocalypse, yeah.
Yes, indeed.
No, it's here to stay, LinkedIn. There's not much you can do about it. I mean, the only thing that could happen is Google or Facebook produce a LinkedIn competitor, which has to happen at some point. Let's put it this way. Rather than specifically saying LinkedIn, I would say your social presence has to be updated and in tune with what you want to do with your career.
So we haven't discussed Santa Monica Talent very much, other than mentioning that you scale up startups.
Yes.
Do you start up scale-ups as well? That's every other week.
You know, the problem with saying we just work with startups is that startups can be anything from 2 people in working from home with a new idea all the way to what's TransferWise today. I mean, clearly it's not a startup. So typically we'll work with early stage companies with software or technology behind the business that is either at Series A, probably to Series C is our sweet spot, before they have an in-house talent team. And we'll provide an interim recruitment talent advisor while they're scaling up. That's essentially the business model. It's a bit different. We're kind of a hybrid. We're not really an agency and we're not really a full-time head of talent. We're somewhere in the middle. And I think it suits our customer base who are growing and need a hybrid type of service.
And how do people get to hear about you other than being on the London FinTech podcast and your business will grow enormously as a result?
LinkedIn.
Oh, right. Okay.
Please send me a DM on LinkedIn. Always happy to talk to people. You know, we love speaking to all sorts of early stage companies. You know, I like hanging out with the fun early stage companies and entrepreneurs. It's just a nice environment. And I've also worked, I spent 10 years working with investment banks. That was in the Asia Pacific markets. And that was a more traditional headhunting role, working with IBs for 10 years. So I've done both now. I've spent 10 years working with investment banks and now the last 5 years working with high growth startups. Both have been enjoyable.
Great. Okay, well, we've covered quite a lot of ground there and I'm glad I'm not in the market for a job because otherwise I'd be feeling very guilty. But all of those of you decades younger than me ought to actually implement some of this stuff. It's one thing knowing about stuff and it's another thing actually doing it. And in a sense, professionalising yourself means that you'll get more opportunities going forwards. And I quite like the idea of actually having some courses telling people how to get recruited. It's an always changing world. So thanks very much for that, Ellis, and I wish you every success in the future.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory/non-exec on media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey, with the pain of the the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight dance.